Good day, everyone. This is the Dot Matrix podcast. I think we're on number 28.
You gonna say your name?
Yes. I am Sean.
I am Justin.
And this is a special episode because we're podcasting for the first time from Justin's pad here. So, well, yes. It's much more than a pad.
Well, you're making it sound like it's a mansion. It's just a house. An old house with weird pipes that we were talking before we started to record. And, yeah, it's kind of neat. Like, it's a Saturday mid-morning, sunny outside. You've just broken a pen.
No, it's good.
Okay. it's here. And so you have the tea. I have my morning coffee. Not my first cup, of course, but...
Somersault Bear coffee mug? Is that what that is?
Yes, a Somersault Bear coffee mug. It's one I got when I was on exchange. Yes, I was in my early 20s at the time, but it's the only cup I brought back from my time there.
Right on.
Yes.
Was that the Rotterdam? Or
Rotterdam, yeah.
See, do I know your past?
You do know my past.
I have almost the memory of a girl.
But what?
No, not quite.
What is that? Reference.
Female memory is amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah. I find. It's like women can just remember almost everything.
Yeah?
Compared to us guys sometimes. I won't speak for you, but I have a lousy short-term memory as it is, but when it comes to like details in the past, I know dates. And that's why, you know, Elaine always brings up. I know dates. Dates of history, dates of cultural history.
Hard facts. You're good with hard facts.
Good with hard facts if I'm interested in the topic.
Right. If you don't give a rat's ass about Julia Child's history, you don't really know when her first TV show was on. And you know,
well, I might actually.
You might? Okay.
I could probably give an educated guess, but we won't go there.
No.
Oh, speaking of her.
Yes.
When we were in Whistler, you know, we spent 3 days in Whistler.
Yes.
We
More successful Whistler trip than I had, that's for sure.
Well,
no, don't tell me.
it was very successful.
Absolutely.
There was a couple of hiccups with other people there, but that was a story for another day, maybe a future podcast.
Oh, I'm sure.
When we talk about customer service.
Yes, customer service.
But I have to say, the hotel itself was great, and there's a TV there, and as you know, we don't have cable or real TV at home.
Yes, yes.
So we were flipping the channels like crazy whenever we were inside, and we came across Julia Child in black and white cooking something.
Yes, that's PBS. Been on PBS. Yeah. It's like, you know, Memories or something. I've watched a little bit. Vanessa was watching it, and then she told me to watch it, and we were watching this one episode, black and white. She was making bouillabaisse.
Ooh, nice.
And, well, yes, nice in color. In black and white, it looks like the most disgusting thing ever. It was right. Just like you see a gray looking fish and a gray looking
I saw one with scout. Fish on a plate. I might have been watching the same one.
We were like, oh god, that just looks so awful. But then there was one like from the 70s in color, and she was making this omelet party. Ooh. And it was quite fascinating. Like
that's cool.
Yeah, that was kind of cool.
Well, one thing that struck me as like really awesome was that unlike some of today's cooking shows is they show her and they show her making food. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
You see the food she's making, and you see the ingredients she's putting in, and how she's mixing it together and serving it. And on today's shows, they're way too artsy. Everything's all out of focus. Camera shake everywhere. They can't center on the woman while she's talking or the man. And you can barely get an idea of what it is they're cooking because you never see the food. So I was really enjoying it. I was like sitting there like, wow, this is great, you know? Yeah, it's in black and white, but I can use my imagination. But...
Well, so. I think Julia Child, unfortunately, although she's awesome, doesn't quite have the bosoms for television of today, I'm sure, which is what the focus ends up being on.
She's no Nigella.
Well, there's a couple of ones on the Food Network that I flip to where if they're on, I'm like, okay, I'll watch them.
And, you know, I get all of that, you know. I just wish they could take that. It's just like, you know, classical music stars, right?
Yes.
Like, the guys are just dressed up so well, and they look really, you know, really nice, you know? And,
yes.
And modern and slick. And then the women, they're wearing, you know, nice tops or whatever, and they're most of them are very slim, and they look like models, yet they have a violin in their arms, you know?
Yes, there's a lot of young women violinists who are promoted like that these days. Yes, that's right.
So I get it. Yeah. But
what's weird, though, is, like, again, with music, it's like, it's... You know, most people who consume music aren't necessarily musicians, but most people who consume television shows on cooking, you'd hope will want to. I mean, the whole idea of a cooking show is to learn how to cook, right, or to get some tips. And I think about one show in particular, and I won't name the name because I don't want to be slanderous or anything. But the host is a very attractive woman, like very attractive woman, and but the way they cut the show, the way they edit the show, the way they show her cooking. You don't learn anything. Like, you couldn't even begin to know how to make whatever she's making. And,
crazy.
And I just don't, like, I don't get it. Well, I get it. Trust me, I get it. But you don't get it, you know, at the same time. Right?
Yeah.
Anyways, that was not even remotely on our list of things to talk about on this podcast, but
that's we how went it works, there.
That's
though.
How it works.
On that's the dot matrix. That's what we do.
That's how we roll. But lots have been going on. We haven't had a podcast probably in about a month or so, I would think, right?
Yeah, I think I was looking back. It was either early September or late August.
Wow.
Yeah. So no, I think September. We did okay. That. Yeah.
Well, so much has happened. more on the Zhukansky thing, which we keep talking about, which is just so appalling. There's a new Nobel Prize Peace winner.
Yes.
Peace Prize winner out there. There's stuff about happening in our country, in Canada, around the Ignatieff and his views on the world, as I know you want to talk about that. So we've got a huge array of things. Where do you want to start? Where is your blood boiling?
You know what? My blood is really boiling with the Zhukansky.
Yes. Oh,
did I say
Zhukansky? Yeah,
Zhukansky.
I mean, that's how I hear it on the media. So who knows if that's right or not?
Yeah. And then there's also Polanski.
Oh right, Roman Polanski.
Yeah. Not that I want to talk about, you know, some really lewd acts, but I want to talk about how society is reacting to the latest events.
And you know, to their credit, the media has actually given some airtime to that. The idea of how people are, what is the message when you have Hollywood heavyweights kind of supporting Polanski and using the reasoning of, well, he's a great artist. You know, like there's interesting pieces of that, but we'll get to that when we get to it. Zhukansky.
Yeah.
So write down Polanski so we don't forget. Okay, so Zhukansky.
Well, I guess, you know, my thought on it is that, you know, this inquiry is wrapping up soon.
Yes, and it just started again after that, some sort of email thing that made everything go on hold for months, and now the Braidwood inquiry is continuing, and it, I guess you're saying it's close to being done.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that Robert Zhukansky's mother is now suing...
The RCMP,
the four officers, the YVR, I guess, which is the airport authority... And whoever else, like, there's
and
a whole bunch of people.
I think
people.
British Columbia.
And the province of British Columbia, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the airport, the authority, British Columbia, I think just the four officers.
And the four officers, yeah.
You know, I totally think that's an appropriate course of action, actually,
okay.
for his mother, because, you know, there's a lot of things that she said, not only the awful case of her son dying, but also their treatment of her.
Yes.
They didn't notify her in a timely fashion that her son was just killed. I mean, it was really difficult for her to get answers, and the story goes on and on. I think one of the most worst things is that, you know, they're still, even since the spring they've been doing, but they're still doing it. The lawyers of these cops keep pointing to his alleged alcoholism. You know?
Right.
And it's getting really tiring, and... Now, two of the lawyers of two of the cops are saying that they acted totally under protocol to certain training and so on and so on. But, you know, it's just insult after insult, you know, causing more and more injury. And I think, it, you know, the Polish government officials want us to lay charges, which I totally think they should. If anything comes out of this, they've got to change the culture of the RCMP. They've got to change how they... After an incident happens, how they approach the media, because they've been obviously caught in many lies.
Yes.
Or, you know, poor memory, you know, whichever you want to call it. You know, when they say, oh, he wouldn't go down after the first tasering.
Well.
We know that's wrong. They didn't, you know, they he was in a combative stance. That was wrong. You know, you could list them over and over again. So yes. I'm just looking forward to resolving it and, but not letting it die. Like, let something positive come out of this.
Right. Well, it's funny. One of your Facebook statuses, as you've said many times, is thank God for that video. Like,
yes.
And that is so true. And for me, a couple of things. I was reading comment on, there's an article on CBC News about, you know, the lawsuit, and one of the comments from that article, people can post and say, you know, oh, well, totally supporting the RCMP, totally supporting, you know, against the lawsuit, saying, oh, you know, you haven't grieved, and how can you do this, you know, how can you sue, you haven't let the appropriate time of grieving to pass before you start suing people for, and something about, you know, I mean, yes, he was holding a stapler, but who knows what that stapler could have been, you know, and in these time of terrorism, and they acted appropriately is sort of the gist of the comment. And for me, I was like, well, one, a stapler is a stapler, a stapler. Like, I mean, unless these four RCMP officers have eyesight deficiencies or were blind, which means they really shouldn't be RCMP officers, you can tell what a stapler is, right? So forget that, and forget this is an age of terrorism and an age of the of whatever. Like there should be enough. I mean, the argument suggests that RCMP officers are drones and robots and aren't allowed to have an interpretation of a scenario. And I think the interpretation is pretty clear thanks to the video, right? What Absolutely. Was going on. And in terms of, like, suing, like, I think that's, I mean, she has been, as you described, the mother and the whole process has been so awful mm-hmm. that this is one of the ways that she has to fight back and yeah. to actually get answers and to get vindication and to make things happen. And I think it's part of the grieving process. I don't think it has to be separate from the grieving process. No way. This is part of it.
No way.
I mean, when things are done to you, as it's been done to her,
yeah,
you have to find an outlet in which you can control, that you can be in the driver's seat. That's part of grieving, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think that's absolutely right. And as we know, from thanks to O.J. Simpson, you can be acquitted in a criminal trial, but you can be found guilty in a civil lawsuit, and it's equally as tasteful, you know, in terms of vindication for the yeah. people, right?
Yeah.
And I hopefully this, when that comes out of the Braidwood inquiry, which is something it's not going to, in terms of changes to how the RCMP handles their processes mm. and protocols and looks upon themselves and investigates themselves, maybe the civil lawsuit will provide some of that vindication, some of those changes, because it seems unlikely, at least, that even though the overwhelming testimony has been pretty awful, that they're going to not lay charges. I mean, that's my sense. I mean,
that's what they've said.
So like, then how will things change? Like, yeah. you know, like if you don't lay charges, and people are not above the law. I mean, the Supreme Court of Italy said that just the other day, that Berlusconi is not allowed to pass laws through parliament that immunizes him from prosecution.
Right.
Like
that's,
and,
crazy.
And this, you know, we know the culture and the stereotypes of Italy. If that Supreme Court is saying that the Prime Minister is not above the law, then RCMP officers should not be above the law on what they do.
And
you know,
yeah, and one of the biggest tragedies is that people are losing confidence in
the RCMP. Yes.
And it's really too bad, because, you know, I was looking back at some news items like on the National and other things like on YouTube of recent months. Thinking about, you know, how we were going to talk about this, and back in June or something, you know, they had a thing on how RCMP officers, former RCMP officers from across the country are coming out, and a few of them were on the show where they're like, this is awful. Like, these guys should be charged. People don't have confidence in RCMP anymore. I'm disgusted by all this stuff. They didn't act appropriately. They didn't assess the situation. It was 35 seconds from when they arrived to when they tasered the guy. They all had bulletproof vests. If you look at the video, when he put his hands up in the air and he started walking away from them.
Yes, yeah.
Away from them. He, I repeat, they were surrounding him. I mean, the four guys were in a semicircle around him. And then the guy says, get him, you know, shoot him. And it's unreal. Like the guy who, I think the guy who shot him, who actually did the tasering, was probably in a weird position because he's getting the orders to shoot.
Yeah.
Get him again. Yet, I wonder, has he ever thought in his head, like, shit, should I be doing this? Like, again and again and again? Like, guy's already on the ground.
Right.
So...
See, but that's part of, to me, I think the authoritarian nature of the RCMP and policing in general. I think part of the theory is, that's why there's ranks, right? And you're not allowed to act. You have, like, part of your job description is to follow orders of the people above you, which is part of... To me, what's kind of an oddity in the culture and in the rules and policies of policing, but I don't know policing, right? So when I think about policing the police, which is what the argument here is like, well, should the RCMP,
how do you do it?
How do you do it? I agree with some of the argument, which is why it has, you know, why I think part of the argument, I don't know this, but my assumption is, would be the police should police themselves because they understand the context. They understand the culture. They understand, you know, stuff that just normal people wouldn't get.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you can resolve that and still have, which is what everyone else wants, which is an independent body. You know, like, I really think it has to be independent. It cannot be internal. Like, how do you, you know, but it, whoever, whatever the body needs to be made up of, probably former RCMP officers who understand, but who is far outside of the force now. And maybe has you know, X number of years out in public life to try to remember what the other side is.
Yes.
Plus probably some, you know, people who have never been in the RCMP and whatever. Just
like a balance.
Yeah, you need some balance. But I think, you know, maybe if you want to have a current RCMP officer or some officer from another force, you know, maybe it's like from Vancouver police who does the RCMPs and the RCMP who does the Vancouver police. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I don't know. Or maybe it's someone from New Brunswick police or something. So it's much more far removed. Or I don't know what it is. But like some sort of combination. That's the way it is with society. It doesn't have to be one or the opposite end of it. It can be somewhere in the middle. I mean, there's Canadian solutions in everything, you know?
Yeah, and I just think, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, like this is... A lot of RCMPs are like, this is protocol, this is the Canadian way. It's like, no, it's, you know, like the guy who was giving the orders has, you know, they've investigated him too, like into his past and his history. And he's, you know, he's been involved with some controversy before. And so, you know, like, was he the guy that was supposed to be in that role? Who knows? You know, right. There's so many other questions it brings up.
We know with Law and Order episodes, it's not just who you hire to kill is the one who gets charged, but the guy who does the hiring too.
Oh, yeah.
So, anything else on Jakansky?
I think that was pretty much it. We'll just look forward to, we'll be coming back to this after the inquiry's done.
Absolutely.
And as the lawsuit brought on by the mother progresses.
Mm-hmm.
And I for me, the biggest clincher is, like you said, is what I said earlier, it's the video, because it would be, we wouldn't have an inquiry right now if it wasn't for that video. They have a lawyer of one of the cops the other day saying the video is unreliable. Like, it's unbelievable what they throw at this thing. It's like, the video doesn't lie, you know? Like, I know sometimes there aren't the greatest videos of events.
Right.
That, and you have to look at context. You have to look at behind the scenes and stuff. But that video was a 10-minute video of the whole episode. Like,
right.
It is way clearer than any memory of these guys or, you know, what they want the public to believe. And it's like, they've been proven to be conflicting, you know, based on what we see in this video. Like, we have to remember that. Like, we wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for this video. Like, it would be, these guys would be like, oh yeah, this guy was nuts. He was throwing shit at us. We had to take him down. You know, that would be the end of it, you know?
Right.
That's all I keep saying over and over again.
You know, the one thing I will, before we get to Obama and his Nobel Prize, is the one thing I thought was interesting is that, I mean, just to bring it close to home, because there's no closure yet, because there's no changes in policy yet, I mean, there's minor things that they have now. I think probably the YVR, they have more interpreters or whatever, like maybe that's going on. But I was having coffee with a colleague of mine who I know through work, and she has a boyfriend who is Polish. And she was telling me the story about her boyfriend's brother came to visit over the summer. And her boyfriend's parents have come and are living here as well. But the brother had never come before and speaks no English, but was from Poland. And everyone was highly sensitive when he was coming in because they were afraid whether or not he would. I mean, can you imagine, like, if you're someone and you just, your brother's coming for a visit, you know, it doesn't matter what country, but, you know, but to be worried about whether or not
they're going to make it past,
and get out, you know, like
the security zone. Or
like,
whatever.
That's totally unfair. And that's,
it is.
And what happened was, is that apparently, like, the plane arrived and everyone deplanes and the brother's not on, doesn't come out. And he doesn't come out for an hour, 2 hours. And then everyone's freaking out about what's going on. And apparently what happened was he had a return ticket to go home, but in his suitcase was like a whole bunch of personal effects, like photos and stuff like that. And so I guess customs were a bit concerned about whether or not he was actually thinking about just coming and going, or whether he was just coming but it's just going to stay in the country, right? And so they held him back, asked questions. But of course, you know, how can you ask questions? How can you answer questions you don't even understand the questions, right? So there's a bunch of that stuff. So he ended up coming out safe, and it was all okay. But I mean, I just figure, like, that's just unacceptable. People should not feel for their lives coming, whether or not they will exit customs and exit the airport alive. Like, it's crazy. It's
in this day and age, and in our country, like, that's not right. And that's totally correct, because do they not have, like, I know they have interpreters there, but do they not have this system where at some point between getting off the plane and getting into the free zone, that where if people are having problems, like, there's someone they can talk to? Like, there's someone looking out for people coming into the country? Like, it just seems like you're on your own. Like, we've been through YVR a million times. Like, when I got off of the plane in Paris, like, Air France, yeah, okay, I can get around because I know French, but, and it's, you know, it's not a huge difference between French and English, like French, English and Polish, like, I get that. But when we got off, it was such a big airport, Charles de Gaulle, and there was one point where getting off the plane, going to get our luggage, where we weren't sure, because we ended up in this area where there was a lot, you know, like the, those conveyor belts and stuff, and they bring out your luggage.
Yeah, luggage carousels, yeah.
There was a bunch of them in a row, like, in this one wing, and we saw nothing. We saw no other passengers that looked familiar to us that were on our flights. We're like, okay, where are we? So I end up asking this lady in this, like, info center or something, and she said, oh, you know what, flight number. So I told her it was all in French and all that. She was so nice, you know, and I was so relieved, because she pointed to which direction to go exactly, and we made it, and it was great. But there's these, what do they call that? Like, no man's land kind of pockets around, you know, some airports where you just, where am I? You know? It says, you know, everywhere, but it's just not clear, you know, right, where do I go? Yeah. So I think, you know, it's important that at YVR, and I thought it was straightforward at YVR, but maybe it's not. For someone who doesn't know the airport.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, that's a big topic of ours.
So, Obama. Just came out yesterday. Nobel Peace Prize winner. Out of 205 nominees, apparently, for the Peace Prize, he was chosen unanimously.
Unanimously?
By the Committee of Five. And something about, yeah, Obama is humbled, accepts the award, and looks at it as a call to action. as opposed to a recognition of accomplishments, I guess, is the, and that's sort of the big debate, right? Which is, does he deserve it because he hasn't really done much, and there's nothing concrete has come out of this new sense of hope, or do you recognize, because hope is just so much, is in itself an accomplishment, because it is true, 8 years of the previous administration has caused, you know, to wipe that out within just a single, just because you were elected, just because of who you are, that does kind of speak volumes in some sense, but is that enough for the Nobel Prize? And I guess conversely, does that mean it's a slap in the face? They're giving it to him because they're not giving it to Bush, you know, like, that's right. Which is sort of part of that. So where do you fall in this debate?
You know, I thought a lot about it because as soon as it came out, I kept reading a bunch of things and different points of view, and this is what I have to say on it. I think it's deserved. At first, I was like, wait a second, you know, they're involved in two wars, so on and so on. But the amount of hope that you were talking about that he's given to a lot of people around the world, I mean, people were dancing in the streets around the world when he was elected. So such a contrast to the previous administration. I think in 10 months and on the campaign trail, like the year before that or whatever, he's done an incredible amount of work to reach out to most notably like Muslim countries and other countries where they've been, other non-Muslim countries where they've been previous foes with, like Russia and other, you know, kind of rogue, so-called rogue states or whatever. I think the amount of reaching out that he's done and hope that he's provided for people in this world is monumental. And I think it, in that sense, it's totally deserved. They're not going to get this chance like all these other countries and peoples that see the U.S. in a really bad light, deservedly, probably, in some respects, not all, but some. They're not going to get this opportunity again, I don't think. Because it's, what president of the United States have ever gone on TV or internet and spoke directly to, like, Iran?
Right.
I can't think of one.
No.
That was never going to happen in the last 8 years. So I think it's a huge opportunity for other countries. Oh, and other countries like Venezuela, like other countries that are pretty hostile towards the States.
Right.
I think they have a huge opportunity to actually look and start working with the States in a positive way. I think it's never going to be this good in that sense, you know? But the two wars thing, a lot of people are like, well, wait. People are being killed by drones in Afghanistan and Pakistan. People are still being killed in Iraq. And it's like, yes, that's true. That's something he's inherited, yet he's continuing. One, he's ending eventually. The other, he's continuing. But the Peace Prize has been given to other people that have, you know, either a lot of blood on their hands from previous action or current action at the time. You know, I mean, what are you going to do, you know? You got to give it to people who have the power to actually have a huge impact, I think.
Right.
That's my stance.
Well, and I'm going to completely disagree. I'm just kidding. Well, I thought about it too and thinking, I mean, well, one, he, you know, if you get the Peace Prize, like, it's kind of shitty if you actually say, sorry, I don't deserve it. Like, you know, I don't think that would be a very different message.
Yes, I agree.
I think the spinning it as a call to action, not just for the United States, but for the world to engage in what Obama is portraying out there around hope and dialogue and understanding, is good. And I think it's a right shot in the arm for this movement right now, because it's starting to wane because of the healthcare debate, because of, you know, and people had to remember, like, you're right, like that feeling on the election night of such relief and celebration around the world, like, that in itself is an accomplishment, like, and it should be rewarded, and this helps remind the whole world of what that was and what that feeling was, and it helps Obama remind him what it was about. So when you talked about, you know, other countries who are, whose leaders and governments are kind of hostile to the United States, it's a call to them to engage, and And I think, like, hope, I mean, people have to remember, hope is actually pretty powerful.
Yeah.
And the accomplishment thing, I mean, I think hope is a huge accomplishment within the peace portfolio, so to speak. And I think other people who have gotten the Peace Prize with a little bit less controversy, like Al Gore, like others, which I can't name right now because I'm not a Nobel scholar. I mean, linking peace to environmentalism, yeah, a case could be made, but you know, when people think peace, they don't think environmentalism right away. But a cornerstone of peace is hope.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, I think it's worthwhile. It's a little bit unconventional, and I think they probably took that into account when they decided to give it to Obama. And I mean, not to detract from the 204 other nominees who are probably fighting amazing fights,
yes,
in their regions, their communities, their peoples, around equality rights, around peace, around the freedom to live, or what have you.
Non-persecution.
Yeah, there's lots of that. And but Obama and hope, you know, by recognizing that, maybe helps all of those cases by recognizing the overwhelmingness of hope in that sense. So I, you know, I mean, that sounds kind of like idealistic or whatever, but I, in a practical sense, I think to me it makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
No, I totally agree, and I'm happy we agree on that one. Because we don't always agree, but I think we agree more often than we disagree. So I think I'm glad that we agree.
I tend to try to agree with a more conservative view on occasion.
Yes, I often worry about my, you know, slight leaning to conservatism.
Your mutton chops are going to be full fledged old timer. You know,
I look like Ted Nugent pretty soon.
So what's next on our list?
Ignatieff.
Yes, no, this is all yours because, I mean, you, when we were going to do this podcast, you sent me a link to, was it National Post? It was National Post article, yeah. Because Ignatieff a couple of weeks ago did a huge speech about Canada's place in the world and how if he was Prime Minister of Canada, he would, you know, reinvigorate foreign policy, I guess, in that sense, and take it from there.
Yeah, so I, you know, I came across this because I had to do it a lot with, you know, it's very political too, because the Liberals all of a sudden were, you know, decided after propping up the Conservatives for like the last year, they're going to start voting against them now.
Right.
And part of that, you know, is Ignatieff doing that in the House, yet he's going across country in the summer and they have their retreats and they talk to their constituents and they figure out, you know, their new kind of style, and he keeps, you know, writing books about Canada's history and who we think we should be, and now he's come out and said, you know, to the country, like, okay, this is how we should be in foreign policy, and it's every way seems to differ from how we are right now. And it seemed, and what brought me to that article was that there was this link to this guy saying, well, he's talking about the Canada of 30 years ago, how we may have not been so self-assured, self-confident. We know our place in the world. Like it's as if Ignatieff's talking about, oh, you know, the 21st century could be ours. You know, it could be our century. And even though Laurier was saying the same thing at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, and it's like, do we want to keep talking like that? Or do we want to actually recognize our accomplishments and the strides we've taken? And I think there was some truth to that in this article from the guy who wrote National Post. And we'll post that article because I can't remember his name. But even though the National Post seems to be a little more right-leaning.
Yep.
And a lot of the blogs or, you know, commentary in it, opinion pieces are right-leaning. And this guy was, you know. But I couldn't help but agree on some points where he was just saying, you know, when every time Ignatieff makes a speech, it's like we are almost kind of doing ourselves a disservice and we're talking about ourselves in this little kind of small town grassrootsy kind of way.
Right.
When we've had quite the impact on the world stage, you know, with foreign policy and so on. And I just found, I found that was kind of interesting because, you know, Ignatieff's a scholar and, you know, he's impressed a lot of people over the last, you know, 40 years or something with his intelligence. But does that make a strong leader to actually lead the country and to make some actual educated decisions that will affect everyone, not just the elite and not just other scholars like him, you know?
Right.
So I found that an interesting point of view, and but I also found it kind of like, well, is this really genuine, or is this just to help get him into power? You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So I forwarded you the article because I never tend to really agree with a conservative point of view, but, you know, I just think that... at the, sorry, my tummy's making noises here.
We gotta go for lunch.
I know. I just think that, you know, we are way more sure of ourselves as people, and we, I think overall Canadians know where we're going and we know how we're perceived on the world stage. And it's because of technology and the internet and all that now, the smaller world, the greater communication. And I don't think we're exactly the country that Ignatieff paints ourselves to be.
Right.
Where we constantly have to be learning about ourselves. And, you know, I think self-reflection is good. But to a point. And we have to stop talking like that, maybe.
Yeah, I think, I mean, part of Canadian culture has always been to be humble. And there's a difference between... well, there's, I mean, and there's some, there's a difference between being humble and, well, trying to position yourself as the underdog, but being humble, but know your place in the world.
Yeah.
And I think the old Canada is humble and kind of is the underdog. And I guess if you're talking about the Liberal Party of Canada, you know, and you think about human nature, yeah, people root for the underdog. So we're trying to paint, you know, I guess he's trying to paint the country in that light so he can wrap himself in, I'm the underdog, and well, what if I win the next election? Yay, the underdog wins, which is universally what people like.
Right.
Or two, if he didn't win, oh, well, I was the underdog anyways, and I fought the good fight, right?
Right.
Win-win. Yeah, so win-win in some senses, and I guess. But one of the things in the article is that he was saying, like, you know, some of the problems, you know, of what his perspective was, that he was quoting things that were 30 years old or 40, 50, talk about Lester Pearson, and yes, it's a great accomplishment, and we have to remember that. Of course you have to remember that, or you know, but, you know, there's so much more accomplishments of the last, you know, decade that he probably could have equally quoted,
yes,
to make the same point, but he didn't, or he didn't, you know, and so it makes him think, it makes him, the viewpoint of what he's trying to say is, as if he's going to say, you know, and I always joke about this, you know, the next big thing will be computers, or
right,
or the internet is going to catch on, you know, like, yeah. He's kind of, although I think it's not, the message may not be all bad, a little bit, but it seems out of date.
That's the word, yeah.
You know, and I think it's, I think Canada should always be humble, but should be humble with confidence, because, you know, we've had these accomplishments. We don't have to prove ourselves. We don't need to continually prove ourselves. We're just like, hey, we're here. We should be at the table. We should have a seat at the Security Council, which is up for grabs now for us, and all these different things. Or when we say something, we think people, we believe people should listen to us. I mean, part of the only problem is that there's country and then there's people, right? And yeah. If you think about, I think Ignatieff, whether you believe him or not, probably could be a solid, powerful foreign affairs minister.
Yeah.
In any government.
Yeah.
And I think in the foreign affairs realm, you need a country to back you up in terms of your reputation as a country, but the individual who is the voice of foreign affairs, whether it's the prime minister or the foreign affairs minister, need to also be strong. And if you think about what's going on right now, when you juxtapose us next to the United States, you have Obama as the president, and you have Hillary Clinton as your Secretary of State. And in Canada, you have Stephen Harper, and you kind of have Lawrence Cannon.
Yeah.
It's hard to exude humble confidence next to those, you know, and I guess to me, it just shows the lack of depth in the political leadership that we have in this country.
Yes.
I
agree.
I mean, you could probably put Sarah Palin in Secretary of State, and it would resonate, although negatively, it would resonate much more powerfully than Lawrence Cannon going to the United Nations chastising Iran.
Right.
Like, no one give a rat's ass about... Well, people would give a rat's ass about what Canada thought if it was someone else. Like, I'm not to say that Lawrence Cannon isn't a bright guy. I don't know anything about him.
Right.
But if I know who he is and I live in Canada and it doesn't resonate with me in terms of our message to the world, then, you know, like, that's an important... Like, it's style and substance in foreign policy, right?
I completely agree. I think that's a good viewpoint.
So, I mean, I think Ignatieff could have the right message. I mean, right now it's an outdated message, but it's veering towards a humble confidence is what we need. But if he becomes prime minister, who's going to be the foreign affairs minister?
Right.
Hopefully not Hedy Fry. Hopefully not other, you know, like there's no, there's
Bob
no depth.
Ray or something.
You know, that's not bad. You know, like, if I think about... I think Peter MacKay, when he was foreign affairs minister, the whole thing about whether he and Condoleezza Rice were getting it on or something. Like, you know, I mean, whatever. But at least it brought some style and substance, you know? Like,
yeah.
He was a good foreign affairs minister. Now he's sort of, you know... I'm not good in terms of, I don't know his policies, but in terms of that style and substance balance, right now we don't have that anymore. No. Not even with the prime minister's, you know, position at the moment, right? There's no style and substance, right? Except for when he sings, you know, Beatles songs at the...
I almost got sick when I saw that. And Ignatieff pointed out, you know, like, this was kind of funny, because Ignatieff was like, hey, like, last year, during the election campaign, he was like, you know, people want to pay for galas and have, you know, elitist cultural figures, you know, dressing up and doing all this stuff, but here he is, going to a gala that his wife organized, you know, and... It's like they constantly shoot their mouth off when they realize that there's probably way more sides to Stephen Harper that anyone even realizes. Maybe not. Probably not. But you know what I mean?
Like, right.
It's he's so dour and he's so just not exciting. You know, sure, they've, you know, gotten some things done and, you know, whatever, but you can agree with their policies or not. But he's not a face for the country.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Well, I think that this, the style and substance debate, I think is really generational when you think about, like, I think other generations who are older than us would prefer substance over style any day. Although Trudeau of the past was definitely style and substance, right? And I think for some reason, I mean, this is just totally subjective thought here. But I think our generation wants both. And I think we should demand both. And for the last 20 years, we've been given lots of, well, actually lack of style. And, you know, arguably lack of substance when you think about the Chrétien years. Like, I don't know how people continually talk about Chrétien as golden 10 years of the country. I mean, like, nothing about that was interesting. Well, except for... You know, the gay rights and gay marriage in the country. I mean, that's...
And not going to Iraq.
And not going into Iraq. So, I mean, there are some. But I think just we demand it, and I think it's possible. Like, I mean, you have to hope for that, right? I mean, again, hope, right? But I think people over the last number of years, I mean, and apparently from what I've been told, when you get older, you become more... conservative and more like, oh, well, you know, you lose hope and you just like become more pragmatic. Right. And I think if you get older and you want to be more pragmatic, then you want substance over style. But I think, and just because you want style doesn't mean that means you don't want substance. Well, I think you can have both and you should have both.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I don't know if Ignatieff's it. I know Jack Layton isn't it.
Oh, boy. So Polanski, thinking about style and substance, Roman Polanski,
obviously languishing in a
Swiss.
Yes. I always get Sweden and Switzerland mixed up, unfortunately.
Yeah, very different.
SW. Anyway, Swiss jail, not out on bail.
But not
he's
being
like remanded, no? He's pretty much.
I'm not sure what his position is, but he's definitely not in a stage where he's being extradited to the United States yet. Like, there's nothing, no talk of that.
He's kind of languishing, but a lot of people are like, okay, should he face the music? Should he face some trial for being a fugitive?
Oh, right, yes, yes, and new charges.
New
yes.
charges, sorry, for being a fugitive. Or getting back, turning the clock back 32 years and having sentencing.
Right.
You know, that he skipped out on. I think, you know, I was surprised of how many, you know, Hollywood people and others have come out in support of just nothing happening.
Right, given, and just for people who don't understand, he was charged and he ended up pleading guilty.
Yeah.
He was charged with rape, but then he ended up pleading guilty to a lesser charge of unconsensual sex or something like that, like with a minor or something. Yeah, assault yeah. or something. With a 13-year-old, and from what I understand of the circumstance, this is like 30 years ago or something. Yeah. It was in Jack Nicholson's hot tub. And when some people talk about, oh, well, it's Jack Nicholson's hot tub. I mean, like, is that some sort of international waters or something where anything is possible? And she was 13, and he gave her some sort of roofie, from my understanding, like some sort of drug of some kind or something.
Quaaludes.
I don't even quite get what that is.
It was just a popular drug at the time.
Right. So and then basically had unconsensual sex with her. So he drugged her and had sex with her, basically, are the facts. And then, from my understanding, too, is that his defense is that the prosecution reneged on some sort of aspect of the plea agreement, and so when he was going for sentencing, he fled. So the facts are that he pleaded guilty, so he doesn't dispute the facts.
Right.
And then he's fleeing because of it, of something around the plea agreement where he wasn't being honored. So.
And I think the thought is that he was afraid that they would put him away for much longer than, they'd end up putting him away for like way longer than he anticipated or something like that.
Yeah. And so for me, that's not really about the facts. For me, it's about what you're getting at, which is the fact that a lot of people in Hollywood are defending him and talking about he shouldn't. Oh, you know, he's a great artist, or it's Jack Nicholson's hot tub, or what have
and
you.
She and she looked 25.
And she looked 25
at the time. But you know, it's just like, I think he should have to face whatever's coming.
I think when you plead guilty, so you have to face the consequences of what you're pleading guilty of.
Had this been and had this been any regular other person, we wouldn't even be having this discussion. It's because he's a filmmaker, he makes great movies, because of who he is, and it's a classic celebrity thing, but he raped a 13-year-old. Like, not 16, not 15, 13. And I think, I don't know, maybe I'm sounding conservative, but...
Well, and there's something about, yes, there's a different culture and a different world in Hollywood at that time, as there is a different culture in Hollywood as it is today than everywhere else in the world. But facts are facts.
Yeah.
And I think you can even have this debate if he pleaded not guilty.
Yeah.
But he pleaded guilty. He said, yes, I did this. So, yes, you did this, so case closed.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it really speaks volumes when, you know, like, Martin Scorsese's one. Like, he's one of the people that are like, I don't think anything should happen to him. It's like, yeah, but you gotta ask yourself, like, if you had a 13-year-old daughter, what would your thoughts be, and how much would that change your viewpoint?
Well, and the fact that he's fled... I mean, when you talk about new charges, I find that really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Like, he fled, and he's been
a fugitive.
Fugitive for 30 years, or however many years, and sort of like OJ. I hate to bring OJ Simpson on again, but when he was fleeing on that Bronco, that speaks volumes, as well as you know, the fact that he was choosing which countries to go to. Like, he knew what he had done, which is fleeing, was wrong. And
but they couldn't use that in court. It was inadmissible somehow.
So it's just kind of weird. Like, I He knows he did something wrong. It impacted his life for 30 years because he knew he did something wrong. And now that's supposed to be, oh, well, you know, that's all is forgiven. I don't know.
I just think it's too easy. And it sets up a huge precedent, right? That's my thing. It's kind of the legal ramifications. It's like, yeah, the victims is even saying, I don't know if, you know, they've settled financially, like in the 90s right. or something. Like, she's already brought him to court for something, and he's agreed to pay her some however amount way back, like, 15 right. years ago. But it's almost like the case is almost beyond her now.
Right.
Because he's a fugitive, and right. had it been me or you, they'd be looking for us.
Right. You know, well, when you think about it, like, I mean, some of the argument is, like, I've heard some of the commentary as well, you know, Charles Manson could have been a great painter. He was still Charles Manson. Or is Charles Manson?
Yeah.
You know, just because they have a great talent somewhere else that has nothing to do with their crime doesn't mean they're not a criminal. Or when you think, not even the artistic realm. When you think about that bishop, who had child pornography on his computer out in Nova Scotia or in Nova Scotia, and he was single-handedly pointed to as the person who really helped broker the one of the first and precedent-setting settlements in the Catholic Church for abuse in the residential schools, that's a great thing, but he also has a whole bunch of child pornography and but they're still charging him. They're not saying, oh well, you know, he did that great thing, so let's right. you know, well exactly. you know, like. So it's not a double standard for this archbishop, which it really shouldn't be a double standard. I'm very pleased about, you know, that they're, you know,
going ahead
and trying to figure this out. But wasn't even on the table. No one ever once said in any media or in any comments about it that, you know, oh well, you know, well, he did this great. I mean, the people talk about how he did this great thing, but they said, well, that's so they only viewed it as a weird juxtaposition between how can you do this and create this very, you know, important process around settling abuse, yet be it, you know, addicted to child porn and that sort of thing. Like, it just, the juxtaposition is so odd. Mm-hmm. While people said, you know, in Roman Polanski's case, they would say, you know, well, he raped this girl, but how could someone who raped a girl create these beautiful movies or these, you know, and then just say there's a weirdness about this juxtaposition. But instead, right. they're using that as justification for, oh well, that means he obviously, you know, is a better person than what he did, than his crime. But this archbishop, no one's ever saying that he's a better person because he did this one thing than what his crime suggests.
Right.
Right. Like, yep. And like, it just sort of proves the point of what you said. Like, if it was you or I, like, no one would ever blink an eye. Like me, you know, all the good stuff I do in the community. Oh well, that discounts Justin because he's X.
Right.
Or, you know, Sean, you know, you do great music or you do great work in terms of what you do in your paid world. So, okay, just because you did crime X, you're okay. You know, like...
Doesn't work that way.
Like, the justice system has never worked that way.
It's really weird and how people have actually come out and said those kind of examples. Like, they've given that, you know, like... Yeah, it's really... I was really stunned. Because, you know, people revere other people for certain reasons. Yeah. Like... Someone's a big Scorsese fan. Then they find out he thinks this way. It really can have effect on people.
Right.
Because and it might be a superficial thing to a degree, but like it's you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it doesn't mean they're gonna stop watching his movies. But you just feel this sense of it's a bit dark, you know? It's kinda like, oh, like I don't know. It just can have a big effect on people, and I think it's crazy.
Well, there we go. That's I think this is our last one was kind of ho-hum. This one was good. I'm very, not that I want to be a critic of our own, you know, artistic endeavors. In some ways, this podcast is an artistic endeavor as much as it is a social commentary. But I feel good. Yeah. I feel talked out, though. I'm ready for food.
Yeah, let's go. Okay, well, that was kind of a funny laugh. So, yeah, we'll have a great next month or... whenever, by the time we come back.
Yes, I'm going to be editing this one and posting it, since we're doing it here from my place, and Sean's going to do the description, so who knows how long the turnaround's going to be for that. hopefully they don't screw it up pretty badly. And until the next time, this is the Dot Matrix podcast. Find us at thedotmatrix.com or sign up for our Facebook if you're on Facebook, I guess. You can search for us somehow.
Yeah.
And that's it.
That's it. So, yes, think about Obama's...